And again, you must read this sign each time it appears. The title of my presentation is Quantifying, as you probably know from the program, Quantifying Phenotypic Plasticity Using Genetic Information for Simulating Plant Height and Winter Wheat. The co-authors are myself, Steve Benzinger, Greg McMaster, the late Wally Wilhelm, and Zach Al-Ajlouni. Phenotypic plasticity is the ability of a genotype to produce distinct phenotypes when exposed to different environments throughout its ontogeny. And a lot of people, agronomists tend to use talk about G by E interaction, and they use that term, but I think that's a bad term because it's ambiguous. Phenotypic plasticity is a consistent term. And it's starting to becoming use more in the literature. And here is an example of three diverse publications all talking about phenotypic plasticity from different topics in coffee, wheat, sunflower, grapevine, and leaf damage. The presence of semi-dwarfing genes results in gibberellic acid insensitivity, causing reduced internode elongation and therefore a shorter final height than parental lines without the semi-dwarfing gene. Within the general classes of semi-dwarf, and conventional height wheat, there is a considerable variation in plant height. It's sort of like, if you remember the old movies, not many people remember silent movies, but when you went to silent movies, they used to have a musician play and you'd sing along and you'd follow the bouncing ball. So while I read these slides, you could follow the cursor if you're interested. If you're not, you could, you know, let your fantasies take control. The differences in plant height in the semi-dwarf and tall wheat classes are presumably due to unknown minor genes, which also affect plant height. Because the genotypes used in this study were not near isogenic, and there was a very interesting paper by Flintham, and where he grew near isogenic lines that had different height genes. And it's not possible to directly compare the effect of the semi-dwarfing gene to its tall near isogenic line. And we took a population approach the population of the semi-dwarf genotypes and the population of the tall genotypes are representatives of the unknown minor genes that affect the known major genes. The population approach of using population means based upon known genes and averaged over minor genes also allows one to develop the concept of short semi-dwarf, semi-dwarf, and tall semi-dwarf classes using population statistical approaches. In this in the population approach, the genetic class mean and the standard deviation are known. The mean plus one standard deviation was considered a tall, while the mean minus one standard deviation was considered a short. Simulating plant height for different height classes of winter wheat can serve as a prototype system to demonstrate how genetic information can be used by modifying existing crop simulation models. Plant height was stated previously, is influenced by major genes that are discrete and well-characterized genetically and phenotypically. Although plant height is a complex trait, it is far simpler than many other traits. And also, plant height is easy to quantify. You don't need an expensive $26,000 instrument to measure plant height. In fact, you can get free meter sticks at some home shows. So the goal of this effort was to simulate plant height and winter wheat across a range of environments in Nebraska using genetic information in conjunction with a plant height algorithm. There are two data sets that we used. The data set one was Zach's data set that he did for his PhD dissertation, and it was data collected in the harvest years of 2004 and 2005. From 51 semi-dwarf lines and 9 tall lines. And then the data set 2 was data that we collected from 29 April to 10 June of 2008 and was replicated twice in each plot. Here we just measured final plant height. Here we measured plant height as twice per week. And this is a figure of the different height classes that we had. The squares are the tall, and you can read the rest. And you can see that the some of the talls and some of the tall semi-dwarfs are similar. There was only one short tall over here, and this was and this is the semi-dwarf line, and you can see it was shorter than the semi-dwarf line. And here were the short talls. And this is just a genotype or ID, and here is the plant type. And this is Nebraska. Nebraska is in the center of the country. These are the five locations with different climates that we used in this study. And this is the precipitation and precipitation data. We use the total precipitation for the growing season, sort of as a way to represent a synthesis of the climate. And you could see, like, for example, in Sydney, the average, the mean total annual precipitation is this value, while in 2004 it was 280 millimeters. And it was 100 millimeters more in the next growing season. You could see Clay Center and Mead had, in 2005, were close to or above normal. And you could see, just as Sydney, there was a big difference. In North Platte, it was below normal precipitation in 2004 and above normal precipitation in 2005. And those will be some of the data sets that we use to develop the algorithms and to form the independent data sets. The plant height algorithm was based on the ratio of the mean optimum final height of a height class to the mean optimum final height of the two tall classes. And that's the idea from Flintham's paper, where he had tall genotypes that varied from 100 to 150 centimeters. But if you took the ratio of the different height classes, they were consistent, which was very, very interesting. We used an environmental index, which was based on the plant available soil water or the fraction of transpirable soil water, and a relationship based on that, and we used a negative exponential equation, and that was taken from a paper that Tom Sinclair wrote or published in 1986 in Field Crops Research, and the development stage. And Claudio Stockel was kind enough to supply me the source code of CropSyst. And of course, if you get someone's source code, you always change it because you think you know better. And so we modified that by adding this nonlinear phenology algorithm and then the plant height algorithm. And as I mentioned earlier, the dependent data set consisted of the 2005 data for Mead and Clay Center, and the data from Sydney for both years, because we looked at that for the stress response. The independent data set was the North Platte data for both seasons due to the contrasting environments, and the Lincoln data because of the near optimum environmental conditions. And this is the results, observed heights and the simulated plant heights. And this is for the short semi-dwarf, semi-dwarf, tall semi-dwarf, and the tall lines. And this is North Platte 2004, Lincoln 2005, and this was North Platte 2005, and these are all the statistics associated with this data set. And this is the individual data that we had in data set 2 in 2008, where we measured the plant height as the season progressed, and we did pretty good job considering all the, you know, all the potential variation. One of the things that was interesting, when we over-predicted, those were the years that we had the highest precip. Precip was over 100 millimeters above the normal. Now, is that related to this? You know, just because you have just because you have a correlation, that, you know, it goes back to that old thing, you know, correlation and causal effects may not be the same. So anyway, let me just conclude in, I'm over a little bit, but to repeat what I said earlier in the introduction, people have written about, you know, working together in agriculture. And easy to say, hard to do. For several reasons, ego and turf protection. And but don't forget about creative destruction. And think about Digital Equipment Corporation, and from DEC arose the PCs. And we need to incorporate genomic knowledge that few of us have directly. And so we have to interact with other people that do. And maybe a way to do that is to think about creating prizes rather than, you know, the typical grant system that we have. And if we don't do this, we're going to end up being a fish out of water. And someone else is going to come along and say, we have a better idea. And even though we may be doing crop simulation models and having a lot of experience, people may have better sales pitches than we do, and we can end up here. So I over-exceeded myself by 1 minute, and not on purpose. again, you, okay.
What I'm wondering is if it's not a different space issue, and that if you look at your graph, calibrates well at the lower end of the scale, and then you see that the calibration goes on at the high end. And then when you went to the next year where you were consistently under, that data was almost always from the high end of the scale. Is that correct?
The second year there was a lot more rainfall.
Yeah, we were about 150 millimeters above the normal for this time. And
so what I was thinking then is, if that is your calibration curve, and you expect that to be more normal, which it probably was, and that handles the low rainfall as well as the high rainfall, when you go to a year which is consistently high rainfall, you're going to be in that upper part of the scale. That makes sense, Al?
No. But that doesn't make a difference. If it does, if other people understand it and they're coherent, that's fine. It may have to do with, maybe saturation in the soil zone. And
I would have to guess it's insulation. When you get that much rain, you get a lot of clouds, and so you have less light intensity, and therefore your plants etiolate a little bit. And I'm going to guess that's probably.
Oh, okay, that might.
And cooler temperatures.
Yeah, cooler. Oh, yeah. It's all correlated. That's why I had the table of precipitation, because it synthesizes a lot of things, you know, lower solar radiation versus higher solar radiation versus higher air temperatures. Greg?
Yeah. By the way, I want to say this is the best talk I've ever heard. Best word ever.
In one word, bullshit. But
one of the things we've been talking about is whether the gene expression is the same across environments. And so maybe part of this discussion we've been talking about is, how are you changing the rate of growth across, say, water deficits, or temperature and light, these other things?
Well, it's all mixed in there together. You know, everything's sort of related.
Right, but I guess what I worry about is, if we use often a water stress factor and some kind of, say, linear response to that?
Well, it's not linear, it's curvilinear.
Okay. But that's going to be the key, because I think what's happening with these genes, the summary working genes, when you get down to the really water deficit effects, is gene expression is different relatively. You get the infamous G by E interaction.
Right, well, you mean phenotypic plasticity. But I think we didn't have problems at the low end. We had problems at the high end of precipitation, where we have, you know, cloudy days, a lot of soil moisture.
How do you parameterize the response?
Again, as someone said, if you want to get the right answer, or if you want to get an answer that agrees, you can do it. You can come up with some sort of factor to, and you could play with words to juggle that. Well, we have about 9 minutes. So, Jeff.
Okay. I guess my question is, what are the next steps for modeling effects of the RHT loci? Because their fundamental action, I think, has to do with cell expansion. And they use a good genetics terms, and they have pleiotropic effect, which means they affect everything.
Right.
So it affects root elongation, affects leaf photosynthetic characteristic, affects specific leaf area. And you know, this kind of approach where you just take one trait, seems to me is still far from what we really want, which is take sort of the fundamental effect of the RHT loci and see how they propagate up through the entire physiology of the plant. So what's your next steps on this?
My next step is retirement. But
lay the foundations.
But actually, I've been thinking about that, because I just didn't want to sit on a rocking chair, you know, and watch the sunrise and the sunset. And so I think what we have to come up with new models, you know, because I think what we're sort of stuck in a certain way of looking at how we model things. And so I think in some ways, it goes back to this idea of creative destruction, you know, starting small and sort of building up. You accept what works or what you feel comfortable with based on how you view the world. But I think we have to start again. And I think it's not a person that, in the beginning, you know, like in the history of crop modeling, one person could do it all, because you ended up knowing about, you know, soil, water, about physiology. But we've reached the stage where you can't do that anymore. And that's why you have to get different people working in the at least from my perspective, in the next stage of modeling. And it doesn't have to necessarily be people who come from plant science background. We could give you an example, like in water transport in plants, within the last few years, they started talking about aquaporins. Well, aquaporins, the people who discovered that were physicians who were studying fluid kidney movement in the body. And then plant physiologists picked that up and then found that in the plant system, they're aquaporins. But anyway, that's the key question, Jeff. And I think it's not one person that's going to do it. But I think that's a real good challenge. And Steve?
I guess what I wonder, would it be fair to say that you're going to need more accurate phenotyping so that you can have the data points along the curve as well as more accurate genotyping? The difficulty that we're missing is that we don't know what the minor traits are, what the minor genes are. So you can, you know, we're trying to make sure the perfect isn't the enemy of the good, but we still want to strive for the perfect. So we're assuming that we could remove some of the slop in the models by putting in known major genes. But once you get those in, and you have all the problems of the response to the environment, which most likely will not be identical, then you've got to go start working with the minor genes, which will probably come through association mapping, and you're going to need a phenotypic data set where you can really track to see how it's validated, which will be time points, measurements, to see how the curves fit those. Yes.
Jeff, like in how this was coded is that, you know, the roots won't grow, you know, if you have water stress, the height won't increase, leaf area won't increase. It was all, you know, it's all put together, but it's at the level, you know, it's at a level of understanding. Yes, Greg?
Excellent comments, I agree with completely. The other component is quantifying the environment better. We've talked a lot about that. But at the very least, we don't have any idea of what degree of water deficits the plants were presumably experimenting. So I think it's a combination of what you're saying, under a better definition of environment, or at least measurement of environment.
That's a good point.